So what I wanted to do tonight was I wanted to wrap up what I was talking about with the four mindfulnesses. And I hadn't entirely anticipated doing it that way, but because of Dalai Lama coming to Portland in May and all the other things that I'm involved in as in the lead up to that, I really wanted to begin to do a series of talks that would be related to the theme of Buddhism and environmentalism. Not that I'm an environmentalist, but there are a lot of things in sort of basic Buddhist thought that are kind of could be laid out as a preliminary. So that's what I wanted to do because, among other things, I'm hoping that most of us will be able to go and that, in pulling all of this together, that will be a fit. But I also want to do this in such a way as it relates to our own practice. So it'll be an interesting task to try and do all this stuff. We'll see if it's possible. You're looking a little dubious, Tom.
No, I was just thinking. No, I shouldn't do that.
Well, thinking is perfectly fine, but I could see something was going on, and I was thinking maybe you're getting kind of like, oh, I don't know, this isn't all that interesting. Oh, okay. All right.
No, I think I was just thinking about access to the thing. That must have been running through my mind.
Okay.
Can we all get in there and so forth and so on?
I expect so.
Yeah, hope so.
I expect so. So, of the four mindfulnesses, the third mindfulness is the mindfulness of your body as a divine body. And the fourth mindfulness is the mindfulness of emptiness or the view. And I've talked very extensively in the past about emptiness and basically the mindfulness of the view. There are a lot of recordings online already on that particular subject. And in fact, I've actually talked about a mindfulness of the body as a divine body, which has to do with really part of the technological essence of Tibetan Buddhist practice and what we do. Let me read the stanza that's associated with this and then get into sort of specifically what I wanted to talk about. So the stanza, which is written by the seventh Dalai Lama, is: "In the divine mansion of great bliss, pleasant to feel, abides the divine body, which is your own body of pure aggregates and constituents. A deity with the three bodies inseparable is there. Not conceiving yourself to be ordinary, practice divine pride and vivid appearance. Not letting your mind stray, place it within the profound and the manifest. Making your attention unforgetful, maintain it within the profound and the manifest." So my task is to explain what the heck that means. But in particular, it speaks to the way we do meditation practice in this tradition of Buddhism, which is with images and meditating oneself in the form of a Buddha. That's really what that's talking about. But the way I wanted to introduce this is with something really, well, I've never done anything like this before, at least in this group, but do you all know, maybe you don't, but maybe some of you know this book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces by Joseph Campbell. You know this. Anybody else? Everybody's read it. Everyone knows it. Well, that makes it a lot easier then to do this. Okay.
I haven't read it.
You
I
haven't
haven't
read
read
it?
it, but I've heard about it.
Ah, oh, okay. Well, Campbell is, or was, because he's now deceased, the great mythologist of our generation. And he really brought the idea of mythology as an exteriorization of the Jungian idea of archetypal images. He really brought that to the general public very successfully. And he was aided with all, by all kinds of interesting people, like George Lucas, who followed Campbell very closely. And essentially, when he created the Star Wars series, he based it on this book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. He's very explicit about this. There's nothing covert about it. It's like, here's a hero story. I was inspired by Campbell, and they were real buddies. And toward the end of his life, Campbell was interviewed by Bill Moyers for a very popular PBS series, which really established him in the general public. But where he was interviewed was at Skywalker Ranch in Marin County, which is Lucas's not so much his studios, but the administrative headquarters for his empire, his movie empire. So there's a very tight connection there. But I've been reading this again, and I have a couple passages in the Campbell book that I want to read to you and then come back to again, because they shed some interesting light on the third mindfulness. And they I think, bring what seems like, for some people, maybe an unusual Buddhist practice into a more kind of a, if you will, mainstream context, because it's through Campbell. So let's see how that goes. First, let me read the two quotations that I have from Campbell for you. And in this edition, it's on page 39. It's the Bollingen edition. It's probably the same as every one. The same page for every printing of the book. But this is a quotation from the writings of all people, Saint Simeon the Younger, from 949 to 1022 AD. So this is a Christian mystic. And this is an experience that he recounts. For the one, capital O, for the one who has become many remains the one undivided. But each part is all of Christ. Then he goes on. He says, I saw him in my house. Among all those everyday things, he appeared unexpectedly and became unutterably united and merged with me, and leaped over to me without anything in between, as fire to iron, as the light to glass. And he made me like fire and like light, and I became that which I saw before and beheld from afar. And I became that which I saw before and beheld from afar. I do not know how to relate this miracle to you. I am man by nature and God by the grace of God. So what he's describing is he's in his house. Jesus appears to him in front of him and then merges with him. And he understands that he and Jesus are not different, but also in some way not entirely the same. So first there's the image or the presence of Jesus outside, and then they merge. Okay. So this should sound to you at this point like a lot of what we've talked about in the meditative practice, where you start out with either the guru or the bodhisattva image or what have you in front of you, and then merge with it. It's the same process, although it happens spontaneously here to Saint Simeon the Younger. And here's another passage from Campbell, and this is on page 113. But here he's talking about the meeting with the goddess at this particular point. He says, "The mythological figure of the universal mother imputes to the cosmos the feminine attributes of the first nourishing and protecting presence. The fantasy is primarily spontaneous, for there exists a close and obvious correspondence between the attitude of the young child toward its mother and that of the adult toward the surrounding material world. But there has been also, in numerous religious traditions, a consciously controlled pedagogic utilization of this archetypal image for the purpose of the purging, balancing, and initiation of the mind into the nature of the visible world." So do you understand why I'm quoting this? Shall I read it again?
Yeah.
Okay, let me read it again. "The mythological figure of the universal mother imputes to the cosmos the feminine attributes of the first nourishing and protecting presence. The fantasy is primarily spontaneous, for there exists a close and obvious correspondence between the attitude of the young child toward its mother and that of the adult toward the surrounding material world." In other words, what he's saying is that the attitude that the child has toward the mother becomes, because the mother is matter, because the child comes out of the mother as we come out of matter. So the attitude that the child has toward the mother becomes the attitude that the child has, and therefore the adult, to the material world later. So if you have a positive nurturing relationship with the mother, you have a positive nurturing relationship with the world. And if you have a problematic relationship with the mother, in many ways you have a problematic relationship with the world. That's what he's saying. Okay. But that's only part of the reason I'm reading this. But there has been also in numerous religious traditions a consciously controlled pedagogic utilization of this archetypal image of the Universal Mother for the purpose of purging, balancing, and initiation of the mind into the nature of the visible world. He's speaking to a conscious practice with the image of the Universal Mother, the Divine Feminine, to reprogram one's relationship with the material world. In other words, meditation on images, as in the Tibetan tradition, is not unique to the Tibetan tradition, and he's lodging the practice within archetypal psychology. He's saying, basically, because I think he understands about these practices, and I'll tell you why in a minute. He's saying that meditation on the image of the Divine Mother, like meditation on Tara, is designed to transform the way we relate, not just to Tara as the Divine Feminine image of compassion or active
skillful means,
thank you, in the world, but actually transforming one's relationship to the world, because Tara is the goddess. In a way, Tara is the material world in our own minds. Okay, so now if you put the two quotations together from Campbell, what he's talking about, what he's describing in these two locations, is the basics of the third mindfulness, which is mindfulness of the divine body, or our body as the divine body, which is to say, reprogramming our understanding of our bodies, the material of our bodies, by starting with the image of the Divine Feminine on the outside, Divine Feminine, just like Saint Simeon seeing Jesus, the Divine Feminine starting on the outside and merging with us as the process of reprogramming our relationship to our own bodies. And that's part of what's happening when one is meditating oneself as a bodhisattva image, and in this case, Tara, because that's the practice we're going to move into doing. So that's what I wanted to locate it in Campbell, because I think when one talks about meditation on images of bodhisattvas or Buddhas, for Westerners, until you get used to the idea of doing it and you get comfortable with the idea of doing it, it just seems really weird. It just seems totally weird that you would meditate, if you're a guy, that you would meditate yourself as a green woman. And if you're a woman, to meditate yourself as a green woman is slightly weird too, but not quite as weird as if you're a guy, right? Or if you're a woman and you're meditating yourself as Manjushri, who is an orange guy, you know. So what's happening here? So I'm putting this in the locus of archetypal psychology, but the other thing that's happening is you're working with your own identity. I mean, we identify ourselves as being a certain something. I identify myself as being a Jewish guy on the wrong side of his middle 60s, or the elder side of his middle 60s. Maybe it's not the wrong side, but anyhow, it's, you know, culturally speaking, young is good, old is bad, right? So it's the wrong side. Sorry about that. I know, that's bull. It really is bull. Okay. So I'm on the senior side of the middle 60s, we'll put it that way. Right, so that's my identity. That's my self-image, you know, of this body. Right, but when I meditate myself in other forms, I'm breaking that identity, and I'm breaking the rigid adherence that I have to being a certain something. So why would I even want to do this? Well, the Buddhist way is to understand that every kind of identity that we have, that whether we identify external objects, internal thoughts, our bodies, our minds, other people, we create these ideas, or as Choje would say, these stories, myths or stories, archetypes or stories in a certain way, we create these stories or these ideas or these images or these identities of me, you, this, that, whatever the case may be. And then having created that idea, it runs us and it runs our relationship. And the whole thing could be created out of anything. And not only that, whatever the idea is that we create about something, even if it were relatively accurate one day, sometime off in the future, it's no longer accurate anymore because everything's constantly changing. But that doesn't mean that our identities are constantly changing or our ideas about something else are constantly changing. In fact, my idea about myself might be changing if I'm really working on growing, or if I notice the way I'm aging or something like that. But my ideas about other people might not be changing, you know. The person who offended me a year ago is somebody that I still hold a grudge against, unless I've done something to change that idea about that person. And similarly, the person who's done me a kindness a year ago, who I'm totally open to, may in fact do me an unkindness and I'm not paying any attention to them. I'm not saying that we have to be guarded or something like that. I'm simply saying that we develop ideas and then they become kind of rigid and we don't see what's there right now. What we see is our idea about what's there right now. And that's an identity. That's a concept. Identity and concept really are the same thing. So this really, at a certain level, is what this practice is about. It's assuming a new concept or assuming a new identity, because what it does is it takes the experience. And so here I'm speaking out of my own experience of having done this for the last 25 years. It takes the experience of identifying or the experience of identity, and it begins to make it less firm, less determinative, so that I can create a new identity for myself. I can make myself be something else, at least in a given moment. I can decide I'll be something else. I can change myself, really, is what we're talking about. And that's really a lot of what Buddhist practice is about, is finding the technologies or the techniques for modifying yourself to become something else. So there are ideals about what that something else is, but this is a technology for making the change. And basically what people like the analytic psychologists like Jung and his followers, or Freud and his followers, were talking about, they had a process of that was more passive, of watching the dreams and watching the images in the dreams and whatnot to allow a natural process to unfold. But for the most part, they didn't have a strong idea of how to intentionally move that process forward toward a specific goal. They understood the process. For example, Jung in particular understood how art making would open the creative process and open that dynamic so that more growth would occur more quickly and that you would be conscious of it. I mean, Freud talked about free association and they all looked at dreams. And when you begin to investigate your dream life and look at it closely, in fact, the changes in whatever the growth is that's going on in you happen more quickly because you're participating in that process and you're stimulating whatever's going on in the subconscious and it moves more quickly. So this is the process of psychoanalysis. But they didn't have the idea that you could identify a specific goal with a specific image and you work your way toward it. That wasn't part of their process. But it is in the Christian tradition. The Jesuits do this all the time, by the way. Okay? It's in the Tibetan tradition. And the reason I think that Campbell understood it is it's in the Vedanta tradition, and he had Vedanta teachers speak to Vedanta. He had teachers who were in the Ramakrishna tradition, which also employs this technology of working with images to stimulate growth. So that's why I think Campbell knew about it also. But I can't be sure about that. But anyhow, so that's pretty much what I wanted to say about this, to kind of localize it, as I said, in this particular way. I mean, I could, you know, one could say a whole lot more about this stanza, you know, I mean, it's just packed. I mean, of the four mindfulnesses, the seventh Dalai Lama basically takes volumes and he scrunches it all down to one little stanza, you know, and I was introduced to this again by the Dalai Lama last spring, and, you know, he could have sat there all day long and talked about one of these stanzas without any trouble at all. So, you know, but we're not going to go there. So I just wanted to sort of like do that as a way of kind of creating some sort of closure on a lot of the things I've been talking about for a while before kind of shifting gears into something else and moving into talking again more about dependent origination, our relationship with the material world, and where does this idea come from? I mean, these are the themes that I want to work with upcoming. Where does this idea come from that I'm fundamentally different than the world? I mean, day in and day out, we all feel like here's me and there's the world, and those are two different things. But what's different about me and the rest of the world? In what way? In what way am I any different from anything that's going on around me? I'm made up of the same stuff. There's nothing about me that in any way is slightly different than what's on the other side of this wall. And yet I feel fundamentally that there's a difference. Where does that come from? Why do I have that idea? What do I do about it? Would I want to do anything about it? Well, as long as I... Okay, to get to the idea of ecology or environmentalism, as long as I think what I am is fundamentally different than what's on the other side of this wall, which is a garden, by the way, as long as I think that I'm fundamentally different than what's on the other side of this wall, there's always going to be an environmental crisis because I'm not part of the world anymore. So everything I do is going to be in opposition to what's out there because it's not me. It's what's called the other by my intellectual colleagues. And the other is huge and I'm small. Things are going to constantly be screwed up as long as I and other are fundamentally different. And yet we deeply, deeply, deeply experience that. That's where all the problem comes from, as far as I'm concerned. And so that's what I'd like to start talking about.
Well, it seems to be the case, too, with other people, too. Other
right.
Other beings.
Yes.
As long as you think you're separate, you know, and you rigidly hold the idea of the I rather than being having permeable kind of notion of that, then it's much easier to do harm to others if you don't think you're doing it to yourself. But once those, you know, the boundaries
yeah.
soften a little bit, then you start understanding that that's
well,
not the case.
Yeah,
and I, with the environmental stuff that we'll be getting into, there's a lot of looking really deeply at interdependence and compassion as part of that because.
I didn't hear the first one.
Interdependence and compassion.
And compassion. We really were very involved in all this in the 1990s with Joanna Macy in the San Francisco Bay Area. We took a lot of her a couple of her workshops, and it was very moving material and I think really, really helpful. And she was really a good guide in terms of taking us through the steps of how to approach the environment and not go into what she said, either apathy or denial, or, you know, basically some kind of
about the problems,
about
the deep problems.
But it's the same with practice, too. It's like when you're going deep, you know, inside, too, you're going to run into those kind of problems, too. And how do you deal with the apathy and the denial and the paralysis that comes from that? So it's all really interwoven. And David spent a lot of time talking about emptiness over the last 4 years, and he hasn't talked as much about interdependence, which is the other side of the coin. It's all the same, actually. They, you know, reinforce each other, but he hasn't put so much focus on that, so I think that'll be really good. And we'll be talking, you know, probably going towards Thich Nhat Hanh's teaching some, because that's the interdependence and understanding that relationship to the art environment. He's a master of that. I mean, that's his main focus rather than emptiness. So
yeah.
He's a very good source for small things that we can do to, you know, open up to that. Doing the gathas and little practices and stuff.
He uses the word interbeing,
right.
And Halifax picks that up and really
yeah.
works with that as interbeing with, especially with nature, as that is woven into what she calls the, you know, the fabric
yeah.
of our lives.
I like that.
I mean, you know,
interbeing.
Yeah, we really, I mean, it's funny, you know, words cover things. But words also reveal things, and finding the right words is so complicated, because we're almost inventing language, and we're working in this area, like interbeing. That's a new word. I mean, that, you know, they made it up. In talking about emptiness, people constantly have the tendency to take that idea, shunyata in Sanskrit. Take that idea and they see it in a nihilistic way. So often, I'm prone to want to say devoidness. That's a new word. I'm not the only person who started using it. Devoidness. Because devoidness implies something that's void or something that's empty. It implies the two things coming together. But if you just say emptiness, it doesn't necessarily do that in the English mind. So anyway, that's all an aside.
I'm curious, in regards to the four of you in your practice, have you found that working with the imagery and dream meditation, that is softening those boundaries a little bit, and that you're being able to perceive the other being and the world a little bit more as part of yourself as a result of that?
I see some heads moving
yeah,
up and
yeah,
down.
It has been so fruitful, but rather than the, you know, the wet focused mind, the Theravada method of meditating and then always thinking of for the benefit of all sentient beings. And sometimes it comes to me when I'm, you know, doing an image. It did it last week that. Well, yeah, I am all sentient beings. So for the benefit of all sentient beings, okay, well, yeah.
That includes you.
That
in
includes
the
me.
Right.
I am all of these, you know, the interbeing, I guess. It
yeah.
just kind of, well, these insights come to me when I meditate.
Yeah.
And well, the Dalai Lama impressed to, and I don't know if I've got it in the right way or do it at the right time or whatever, but he impressed to think about the dependent origination.
Yeah.
Well, while you're doing this.
Yeah. Well, and also the thing about, you know, the insights come to you when you're practicing. There were times when we wanted to know things about our own practice. And basically the lamas would say the practice will teach you what you need to know. And that's what you're talking about. You're sitting there meditating, and it's like suddenly you're in what Charles Tart used to call, I don't even know if he's alive anymore, a state-specific consciousness. And in that state, you understand things that you wouldn't have understood otherwise. And it's like, oh, okay, I see this. I get this. You know? And okay. And then you can take it out of that state, hopefully,
yeah.
and, you know, carry it around with you. The rest of the time, because it's usually worth carrying around. Sometimes you can't because it's so state specific, but that's the whole idea. So you get into that place and then the ideas come forth. The sadhana teaches you, the practice teaches you, because it drops you into that mind, or as the stanza says, I think it says it here. Oh no, it's in the commentary. Never mind. I won't get into that. If I get into the commentary, it's like I'll go down the rabbit hole. Yeah.
David,
right.
How is this approach
in the Zen practice when you are not, there doesn't seem to be an image, the goal you were talking about,
right.
Working toward the that relationship. What do you do with the practice?
Well, in Zen, you drop yourself into a certain radically open state of mind. And there are two kinds of Zen practice, for one thing. There's the Soto Zen practice, which is sitting and perhaps watching your breath and not doing anything else, just sitting, as they say in Soto Zen. Just sitting erectly, not moving, and allowing thoughts to go on by without attaching or adhering to the thoughts as they go, so that puts you in an open state of mind, and your innate wisdom can come out in that open state of mind, just as your innate wisdom comes out when you put yourself into a specific state by working with an image. So in that sense, they're similar, but it's not directive in the sense of you're trying to cultivate compassion by meditating Tara, meditating yourself as Tara to cultivate that aspect of yourself. So you're not trying to really evoke certain parts of your deeper self, but you allow them to come forth because they will naturally flower in time. So it's that's sort of the difference, I think. In Rinzai Zen, you're actually working with a specific problem, which is called a koan, which is sort of like a nonsense statement whose purpose is to, at least as I understand it, to elicit a different frame of mind based upon your inability to resolve the problem, that actually generates a different state of mind. I can't speak to Rinzai out of my own practice, so I probably don't want to go very far down that line. I have practiced Soto Zen, so I can speak to that. That's the style of Zen that you would find at Green Gulch Zen Center, for example. Mm-hmm. It would be Soto.
There is chanting, and there are prayers of intention.
Yes, thank you. Good point.
Along with this, and also study. So there's a lot of there's stories which I can't think of what they're called. Not koans exactly. Well, they are kind of.
They're cases.
Teaching cases. That little short ones that a lot of them between student, teacher, and so forth that you study too. So you're kind of in this open space, but you're surrounding it with all these other things that are going on, like setting the intention and so forth.
Yeah.
That do kind of.
Right. Well, here's another example to kind of segue off of what Kay is saying. When you were at Zen Center, were you there when they were doing services, meditation?
Yeah.
Okay. If you were there like on a Sunday morning when they were doing the general meditation and whatnot.
I went into the big hall.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, you would see the monks, priests, walking around with incense, offering the incense to the statues, making prayers, bowing in certain ways, holding their bodies in certain ways, moving their robes in certain ways. Everything is very highly ritualized. And you'd say, well, wait a minute, what is this in Zen? Why is this so highly ritualized? Well, in my view, the way in which we hold an image in mind to drop ourselves into a certain state of consciousness, they're holding what are literally they call the forms of their body and their behavior to do the very same thing. Now, I think that would probably be a radical statement, and my guess is that my Zen friends would give me some grief about this, but I think it's the same thing, that you adhere to the forms, and they're very, very conservative about this, because they understand that they want to transmit the forms through time, that they received the forms from Japan, and they want to perpetuate the forms in the future, because the forms are important. Well, why are the forms important? I mean, if you're thinking about Soto Zen, which is like don't let your mind stick on anything. You know, just sit there openly and let all this stuff flow through. The why, on the other hand, when you're offering incense, are you observing the forms? Why are you supposed to walk through the door into the zendo in a certain way? Why do you bow in a certain way? Why are the physical forms so important? It's because basically, as far as I'm concerned, they're doing the same thing. Those forms elicit a certain state of mind, and they really do. If you adhere to the forms, they really elicit a certain state of mind. It's like practicing Tai Chi or Aikido or something like that. The forms influence what's going on in your mind very, very strongly. Right? So in the Tibetan tradition, they don't tend to be so rigid about things like how do you walk into the temple or something like that. It's like people would just sort of, you know, rush into the temple and sit down and plop on their meditation cushions. But then when they start doing the sadhana, and you watch the mudras, when they're holding vajra and bell and the way they'll be doing the mudras, very prescribed and very beautiful and very, very elegant. And the mudras elicit something in the mind also. And then the meditation's over, and everybody would get up and run out the door and big hubbub and so on and so forth. Which you would never see in a Zen monastery, but you saw that in the Himalayas. Yeah. Right. And so there are cultural elements to all of this also.
But don't you think it's cool that you can have the same meditative experience no matter if you're in a sitting meditation, a focused meditation, a formal meditation? Because in my limited experience, in much different cultural settings, I end up achieving the same state no matter what. And it's the coolest thing that I can always go there, and that's why I believe, my personal belief is that it was all the same.
And Catholic meditation.
It's all the same.
Jew,
exactly.
Yeah.
Ritual.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And Muslim.
And I do this when I meditate.
Well, I really agree with you, Kari. I really do. I think that, you know, different religions describe God or the ultimate with very different kind of languages, but I don't remember who it was that said, maybe it's actually in the Vedas. You know, the words may be different, but the underlying truth and the reality is the same. And I believe that very deeply. And when I put the language together for the religious studies minor at EOU, one of the things that I felt very strongly was, as an educational program, one of the things that was needful was to look at all the different religious traditions in the most respectful way possible and ask the question, in what ways are they similar and different? Because there are differences, but I also believe there's similarities, and I believe really deeply that in the 21st century, if we don't find the places of similarity, there's just going to be more bloodshed. And that it's one of the tasks of academics to look at this particular question and put it on the table and investigate it. And so what I wanted to create as the philosophical backbone of the program was something that I called, that's called the perennial philosophy. So I adopted that as sort of like an organizing principle. Goes back to Schopenhauer, actually, the idea of perennial philosophy. But it's been articulated by a lot of other people, like Aldous Huxley, for example, Jacob Needleman, I can't think of his name.
Burkhardt?
I was thinking of the professor from Syracuse, whose name is eluding me right now, who wrote The World's Religions.
That would be Houston.
Thank you, Houston Smith.
Oh.
Houston Smith. Houston Smith's a great exponent of the perennial philosophy. And it turned out that my colleague at the university, Jeff Johnson, in teaching philosophy of religion, was interested in a Christian philosopher by the name of Hick, who had the idea of what he called religious pluralism. And so the two of us investigated, is the perennial philosophy and religious pluralism, is this a similar idea? You know, and to a great extent they are, as far as I can tell, although there are some differences. But the two of us were sort of working on those issues. Short story long, yes. I completely agree that that's the case. I really do. How can there be more than one reality? And I mean, unless there's no specific reality, and any reality is possible, which is, I mean, I guess that's the quantum view. There's only one reality, or there's no reality. I mean, how can it be that one religion has the truth and all the others are wrong? That's just inconceivable. That's so irrational. That's just like, how is it possible that anybody can even believe such a thing?
But it's hopeful, too, because then if we as human beings can reach that state, that connective state, no matter what cultural background or religious practice we use, then what a wonderful thing to strive for.
I think so.
Reminds me of Tara.
Yeah. And then that becomes a personal contribution to the collective knowing that we're all connected and seeking the same goal.
Yeah. In all the traditions of the mystics, you know, every tradition of the mystics, you'll find it. You know, you'll find those places that, where the experience seems to be, in the reading I've done, experiments seems to be pretty much the same. Once you get to that point, you know, whether it's Rumi or St. Teresa of Avila or...
Sure seems that way to me.
Although I do think the Protestants kind of made a mistake. I don't see a lot of ritual in the Protestant religions. And
I don't think it's in the lay traditions in almost anywhere. You know, like in the, whether it's Protestant, Buddhist...
Or mysticism.
Or, you have to get to the mystical aspect of it before you... Unless you're an exceptional person, in my mind, because it's my belief system, you know, after lifetime of various practice and so forth, I think that a lay person, even one who's not practicing, can have mystical experiences because they've conditioned themselves and done the groundwork in other lives. So I'm not saying it's impossible, but for the most part, I don't think in the lay traditions, I think it's pretty hard to...
I personally think that in regards to what you're saying about Protestantism, I think that the yearning for that in the Protestant tradition is what's generated evangelical Christianity, which is the desire for direct, immediate relationship with God, right here, right now.
Well, we've been discussing that in book club, you know, abyss between fundamentalists and then a more open way, and that's, yeah, hadn't come up with that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the problem with inventing your own path, which is what they're doing, the problem with inventing your own path is there's a lot of trial and error. You know, I mean, the nice thing about a path that's been well trod, you know, like, for example, even the Jesuit path, which has been well trod, even though it's not that old, or the Tibetan Buddhist path, which is much older, you know, or the Buddhist path generally, which is much older, is there's been generations and generations of people who've been working out the techniques and the processes so that it's more established what you can do. I mean, Tibetans have cookbooks for how to get enlightened. I call them cookbooks because that's what they are. It's like you assemble all the ingredients, you cook it for the right amount of time, you do this, that, and the other thing, and here's the outcome. You know, guaranteed, it's going to work if you do all the steps. They've got it all worked out. They got the guidebooks all worked out. They had them all worked out 1,000 years ago already. But Americans don't tend to like that. They call it religion rather than spirituality. That's the issue I get into with my students. Let's say, well, spirituality is good. We like spirituality. We just don't like religion. Why is that? Well, religion is like doctrine, and you're supposed to do stuff, and authoritarianism and all this kind of stuff, so we don't like it, but spirituality is good. Maybe because I'm Jewish, it's never been an issue for me. You know, I look at what they call religion, and I say, yeah, there can be a whole lot of issues with authority. I'm not going to deny that. But received tradition is the cookbook. And, you know, it's like I love to cook and I invent all kinds of things in the kitchen, but sometimes the stuff I invent makes us sick, like as what I made last night probably, which is why we're both feeling kind of weird today, you know. It doesn't always work. The nice thing about the cookbook is if you follow the directions in the cookbook, you're probably not going to get sick. But again, my students say, we don't want to follow the directions.
Yeah.
We don't like religion. We like spirituality, which is somehow more open and free in a way. And I understand that. You know, I'm not unsympathetic to that. But
we've been watching too much Harry Potter. That's trouble.
Yeah, Loy, and then we should take a break.
Okay. This is probably for another time. But you brought up the issue of the danger in religious thought that there is one interpretation of the truth.
Yeah.
And one interpretation.
Dogma is what you're talking about. Dogmatic religion.
Right. Dogma. But it, at some point, look at the major religions. They've taken part of the tradition has taken a turn to fundamentalism, where their God, their rules are all they're the last word. And of course, that's led to terrible tragedy, and it continues.
Right.
And we've experienced, we've watched the split in our own society with fundamentalism and the difficulties. And it just would be interesting to look at what drives that split, what drives that need or that position where dogma is then developed to prescribe a particular way of envisioning
right.
The spirit, the sacred, so that there's no other view.
Kari has the answer.
I have a theory. This is my theory. A lot of people would say it's a power thing, and I think it's really a fear thing. I think it's a fear, and it gets into that faith and fear. It's human fear of immortality, whatever it is, insignificance. It's a fear. That's my theory.
Yeah. I think it's fear too. And on my side, I think it's fear of everybody wants everybody to be like them, and if they're not like them, you know, or somebody else is not like you, then it's frightening. And so you have to have rules and regulations and dogma to hold everybody in check, so that you're all thinking alike. And
right.
that in turn reinforces what you believe, that everything's
right. But isn't it interesting? That's the antithesis of what we've been talking about.
Right.
What the major religions have in common. We've talked about underneath there is a place where there is maybe some understanding of interbeing, as we've used that word, or oneness, or shared humanity, shared justice systems. At what point, what generates that?
You know, you could
fear that drives it another direction.
We focus on the surface of things instead of doing that deeper excavative work.
Right.
And if we were all there at the same moment, we wouldn't need all of the rules, and we wouldn't need all of the agreed upon standards. We would just be, and that's the ultimate.
Right, and I understand that, but that's what we were saying. That's where different religions have.
But you want to know how things.
But it's very interesting that point at which
Houston
that takes over.
Houston Smith, read Houston Smith.
Is that all good?
I don't
religion?
No, but in his last, he's written a few books in the last 10 or 15 years, 20 years, and he addresses this, and I can't tell you which book it's in. But Kay and I were at a talk he did at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco in the 90s, and he talked about this, and it was in something he'd written or he was about to write, so I know it's in his writings. And I'm not going to go into greater detail because you need to stop.
But if you want to turn off the recorder, but isn't this what you started out with Campbell, how we grow up looking, viewing the world, the material world, as the nurturing mother?
Yes, thank you.
Apparently we lose it somewhere along the path. And then so the
there you
meditation.
Go.
And so how do we lose it? Hopefully Houston will tell us.
Well, and so I mean that's a good way to close the loop. Is some people grow up, and they see the world as a place that takes care of them, and other people grow up, and they see the world as a place that doesn't take care of them, and that's somehow related to the way they grew up. And Campbell would say it has a lot to do with their mothering. All the psychoanalysts would say it has a lot to do with their mothering. But it turns out to be even more complicated than that. Because Kay is a person who trusts the world, and her mothering was not exactly the best. And I'm a person who doesn't trust the world, and my mothering was even worse. I'll just say it's complicated, but you're right. You're right. That is part of it. And Campbell would say, yes, that is part of it. But then it gets more complicated. And what Smith talks about is liberal versus conservative types of mind and the consequences of that, liberal and conservative types of mind and the way those kinds of things play. That's all I'm going to say.
All right.